Thank you for joining us to talk about how to prevent disruptions to our toilet paper and national defense supply chains. I'm Chris Grove, technology evangelist at Nozomi Networks, and I'll be moderating today's discussion. Before we get started, I'd like to remind attendees that you can post questions at any time, and we'll try to answer them either as they come up or in the Q&A session at the end. Okay, let's get started. Serving on our panel today are two esteemed colleagues. First, Armando Say, the director of Dreamport. Armando Say is an experienced CISO, FSO, and Department of Defense cleared executive with years of IT program management and business strategy experience. He's currently leading the charge in the development of a cybersecurity services and solutions vertical market. Armando leads the team that's responsible for driving innovation within the United States Department of Defense's Supply Chain Cyber Resiliency Initiative. The goal of the CMMC program is to provide cyber compliance assurance to the 300,000 plus companies that make up the defense industrial base. Additionally, we also have John Almoff. John is the director of global alliances at Nozomi Networks. He's been a member of Nozomi for about 2 years, working in a number of positions in support of our federal government efforts, and is responsible for working with Nozomi's strategic, technical, and business partners. John is also leading our efforts in support of Dreamport and their work with the CMMC, among other initiatives. So today, we're going to explore how the supply chain challenges we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic reflect a much bigger issue, protecting an outsourced supply chain, and more specifically related to the Department of Defense, protecting the theft and preventing the theft of $600 billion worth of intellectual property every year. Over the past 3 months, we've seen major disruptions to the supply chain we rely on for household supplies like toilet paper, personal protective equipment used by healthcare workers, and these are up at close and personal examples of what happens when we rely on third parties, both inside and outside the country, to provide the components needed to produce goods. Toilet paper and disinfectants both had shortages due to increased demand. In the case of hand sanitizers, upping production faced several roadblocks. One, manufacturers aren't typically willing to invest in new machines or new factories because when demand falls back to normal, then they're not going to see a continued return on that investment. Another complication involves the quality and safety of products made by new suppliers that have been asked to quickly retool whatever they're doing before to focus on a new product. In the case of the PPE that's used by healthcare workers and the public, there was a global shortage of the specific fabric used for N95 and surgical masks. In addition, those items are very complicated to produce. Building a production line to produce the fabric takes about 5 or 6 months. Also, most countries had no centralized plan to produce their own medical items and instead relied on China and other countries, which also experienced their own supply chain disruptions related to the pandemic. Most natural disasters like hurricanes and floods impact a single region, and pretty much other regions can draw resources and accommodate what they need to do for that pandemic. But when a pandemic is affecting the whole world, the global supply chain quickly breaks down. So yes, we're connecting fighter jets and missiles to toilet paper and hand sanitizer, because there are valuable lessons that can be learned from the folks responsible for protecting the nation's critical supply chains. On that note, let's begin. So let's start with a question for John. First, thank you both for joining us today. And John, what are the most common things that you see disrupting the supply chain?
Wow, so yeah, there's quite a few that we've seen in place. If you look at a supply chain an organization, right? It's people, processes, and technology. And any one of those can disrupt. We've seen with the COVID-19, Tyson Chicken, for instance, or some of the meat producers have lost so many people that we've seen a shortage of meats in our supermarkets. You mentioned raw materials, right? So the processes for making some of these raw materials can get infected. You know, one that's more close to my heart is some of the disruptions from a cyber attack. So whether it's Norsk Hydro last year or ASCO, some of these other suppliers that make materials for the automotives, you know, they come in many different variations, but they're all damaging to what we all rely on a daily basis.
Yeah, totally agree. And Armando, you're in a very unique position in the world because you have a lot of visibility across the federal government, across private manufacturers that are working with them, and, you know, products that try to solve problems in that space. And you have a very unique position and a perspective that I'm very interested in hearing. And so first, like, what kind of similarities do you see between the protecting the Department of Defense supply chain and things like toilet paper or pork?
Yeah, Chris, thanks for the question. And you see that my background setting here is actually the lab at the Maryland Innovation and Security Institute Dreamport facility, our 40,000 square foot research, innovation, prototyping facility. And in this room is where we test a lot of solutions, and when we test the new information, the new threat indicators that are out in the wide open world that are potentially attacking or successfully debilitating the supply chain. And what we do here is to try to take as much new information as we can, as well as existing threat vectors, and then connect it to a real world sort of ability to test solutions that can help detect and defend against those attacks. So some of the things that we're seeing, as you can probably imagine, deal heavily with COVID-19. Recently, I saw a chart that indicated that when Italy was spiking with their COVID-19 pandemic troubles, the number of cyber attacks against healthcare and the supply chain that provides, you know, the PPE, toilet paper, paper towels, masks, all these vital, vital things that our frontline workers, as well as victims of the pandemic, need to survive and be safe and continue to operate from a mission perspective. So we're seeing things like COVID-19 domains. If you go to CISA.gov, CISA is associated obviously with the United States government, and they've been tracking the explosion of basically nefarious domain names, literally hundreds of them daily that are being spawned up that are doing that. So that's one thing. So there's a lot of fake domains out there that are all with the name of COVID in it that are trying to direct you towards that. The other thing that we're seeing are common attacks that exist today, but things like password spraying and credential stuffing. And if you'd like, I can get into what's the difference between those two types of attack vectors and how they're impacting the supply chain and trying to disrupt it as well. One last thing that I will also mention is fake brokers. So, you know, our supply chain, our factories are relying on raw materials to produce these very critical supplies that we are all relying on as, you know, today and as we go forward. But what's happening is fake brokers are coming up. They're coming up with really good looking websites, and they do a lot of social engineering so they can make sure that they're believable as possible. Checks are being written or funds are being wired for raw materials that the supply chain depends on. The money disappears, and so does the broker, and the factory does not get its raw materials. So those are just three of some of the things that we're seeing, and there's several more on the list, Chris.
Yeah. We've been tracking this also within Nozomi Networks. We've had a couple webinars with some threat intel that we've been sharing with the community as well around the bad guys out there leveraging this pandemic to do stuff. And I've been hearing a lot of also news about, you know, nation state stuff is getting mixed up in there too, and they're also leveraging the pandemic as well. And I can imagine you guys having to deal with that. Our governments are having to deal with that a lot. And I know one of the ways that the defense industrial base tries to work with these kinds of threats is through that CMMC process and model and framework and things. I was hoping that you can tell some of our viewers a little bit about that and how the collaboration between our government and private industry is helping in that space and how it might help us here today.
Yeah, I'm happy to elucidate how we're working with the CMMC accreditation body, how we're working with the Department of Defense, and how we're connecting those two elements with industry. So as an independent body here at the Maryland Innovation and Security Institute, we can act as a frontline neutral party that connects industry with the defense industrial base or the supply chain to government at large to the kinds of things that the government requires. such as the cybersecurity maturity model certification. As you guys know, that's coming hard and fast. Katie Arrington, CISO at the Department of Defense, has hit just about all of her marks on time, just as she said she was going to do it. And so it's coming along aggressively. Like everything out here in the world, it's got a little bit of a COVID challenge here and there in terms of things that are normally done, you know, on person to person, but I think those are going to be overcome. So what are we doing with the CMMC? What we're doing is looking for solutions that help bring down the technology investment and the compliance process and costs associated with complying. In a COVID-19 challenge world, automation is going to be really key. And as I travel virtually throughout the country talking to existing third-party assessment organizations, they're relying heavily on automation and have been relying heavily on automation. A lot of times I'll get questions, well, how is automation gonna assess a policy or a procedure, right? Definitely not saying that automation solves that problem within the CMMC by virtue, or that 100% of the challenge of doing an assessment is solved. But the idea is to minimize the number of manual processes that it takes to get the information needed to do an assessment. And believe it or not, a high number of those practices within the CMMC can be gleaned, or information can be gleaned through automation. Again, not 100%, but a lot. Anything that reduces labor and reduces time, which reduces cost. So CMMC is rolling out. The CMMC accreditation body is working really, really hard on training standards, those training standards are going to be used to accredit assessors. There's going to probably be a provisional assessment model. Katie Antrin and her team are going to pick out the initial sets of DoD contracts that are going to be used to do the first set of assessments. And then the provisional assessors will go out and do that. What we're trying to do is to prepare a small cadre of manufacturers to be ready to be assessed. So imagine if you're a critical supplier to Lockheed or Raytheon or a critical DoD program, you're in that supply chain. And the strength of that supply chain is only as good as its weakest link. So you take a large business, you take smaller businesses, and then those small businesses also have a supply chain. Trying to encapsulate that into a risk sort of assessment is what the objective is. Today, there's not a single button that the Department of Defense can necessarily hit to determine what the cyber resiliency is of its supply chain. And unfortunately, the adversary continues to take advantage of that. They can tackle the Pentagon. They definitely have tried doing that. They can tackle a Lockheed or a Northrop or one of those large organizations. I'm sure they see cyber attacks every single day. They're going to find the weakest chain in the link. That's what we're working on. Buying down the risk, increasing the cyber resiliency of the smaller elements of the chain. And these are the critical supply chain manufacturers, which represent the bulk of the defense industrial supply chain. But I'm hoping that was informative.
I think there's a great corollary, Chris and Armando, to what we're seeing in the physical world right now, where one of the key aspects to how resilient as a country or a world are we going to be is how many tests can we do? How do we validate that people are safe to go out in the world? And there's a very similar corollary on the cyber world, which is the CMMC part, which is how do we not only, if people say, yeah, we're good, but how do I test? How do I ensure that? And that's really the goal of the CMMC, right? Is just like COVID testing is in everybody's front of the mind right now for the virus. Similarly, on CMMC, it's the case for, or the equivalent for, a cyber test.
John, and so as you know, assessment standards, they have a model within that says, you know, examine, interview, and test. What we're doing, you know, even in partnership with your organization, is figuring out how do we accelerate and provide the fidelity that's associated. Today's world, when you look at the way people approach cyber resiliency from a policy perspective, believe it or not, a lot of it is separated from actual data, cyber data. One of the things that we're trying to do is saying, well, they shouldn't be separate islands where one person is on one island to do the assessment, the other person is providing information from the organization and cyber-related, you know, data to basically bring the picture together. What we're trying to do is consolidate everything into one platform such that when you're looking at the pathway towards compliance or the roadmap towards compliance, you have your cyber data and you have your policy data, and then you bring the two together a lot faster, a lot quicker, with hopefully a reduction in costs. And we think we are seeing reductions in costs and helping to accelerate that process in an informative manner. Today's supply chain, they're not trying to be cyber experts. They're not trying to read X number of hundreds of pages of the NIST. That's just not the way we're going to get the supply chain resilient. These are CEOs, COOs, factory floor managers. They have a job to do, which is produce those vital products. The Department of Defense has a vital job to do, is to procure those vital products, but ensure that they're not already infected through various elements of the supply chain. And that's what we're trying to do by looking at various solutions, looking at the contemporary threat environment, as well as the historical threat environment. As you guys know, a lot of the threat vectors that are used against the nation and against its supply chain aren't necessarily brand new, right? There's not a zero day born every day, right? They're really repurposed, you know, living off the land sort of threats that are reused in a very customized way, in a very targeted way, a la COVID-19 against the supply chain.
Exactly. Yes. So testing seems to be a common theme here, whether it's the Department of Defense supply chain or it's fighting COVID. And I think that it would be pretty easy to extrapolate that into our cybersecurity for even just risk management in general, not even the cybersecurity, for everything that we produce, and being able to test that and measure that and run as few tools as possible to do the most seems to be something that a lot of people are trying to do, and which is a good direction, because, you know, a lot of companies don't have, like Armando, I know that a lot of the base that you deal with, the 300,000 plus, are, that's a lot of small and medium business, right? That makes up the bulk of that. So they don't always have the resources to go about it in a very methodical and formalized way. So getting as few tools as possible to do the most for you is probably gonna help a lot. But moving forward, thank you. Moving forward, what do you think, like post-pandemic, what kind of challenges are we gonna be facing after all this? Let's say we've, you know, tackled the automation, and what are these manufacturers gonna be dealing with coming out of the pandemic? Let's look at the back end of it. What do you guys think about that?
Let me start real quick, and then I'll let Armando add in. I think there's extreme parallels to what we see in the physical world right now, where the big concern coming into the fall and the next reemergence of this is, how well are we gonna be prepared? How resilient is the country gonna be, or the world gonna be, to be able to handle the next outbreak and be able to do that? And the way you do that is, you've got the ability to trace, you got the ability to test, you've got greater resiliency that we're building up. And I think there's great parallels to cyber world. Is what CMMC and the programs are trying to do is, how do I build resiliency? So we know this, the bad guys aren't gonna just stop in 6 months. Once we say we've got this program announced, they're gonna keep going, right? Whether it's nation states or backyard hackers, they're gonna keep going. And I think the more resilient, the more that we've got this testing and companies more resilient, is gonna help us avoid future long-term, you know, attacks.
What do you think, Armando?
Yeah, John, you know, one of the things that we're looking at here is a whole cornucopia of different things. Like right here in this lab, for example, as our organization, in terms of its headquarters, we're widely dispersed. Our mission is global, so we go wherever the solution and wherever the talent happens to be, if that's where we need to get the work done. But in terms of our facility, which is, you know, I like to call it the United Nations of cyber for the most part, so many different foreign partners come through here, from the DOD and from, you know, ambassadors and their emissaries, you know, associated with cyber. Well, you know, a lot of that stopped pre-COVID. You know, I think on our calendar, we had Australia and New Zealand scheduled to come in right before the COVID-19. They were going to visit the White House and then come here for some cyber discussions, and all that came to an end. Well, that's going forward post pandemic, and I think we're not ready to say that, right? Because there's a lot of challenges associated with the virus that we just don't have a handle on. We don't have necessarily reliable testing. We see what's going on, you know, in Washington, D.C. with testing. One day you're negative, the next day you're positive. But let's talk about, you know, how the workforce is impacted. One of the things that we're working on is, how do you operate in a socially distanced manner? I'm here in the lab, and these people are off camera, but they're way on the other end of the lab. We operate within a 40,000 square foot facility. You guys have been here when we've had, you know, a couple hundred, 300, 400, 500 people in this facility. That probably won't be the way we operate going forward. What is the way we go forward? How do we check the health of visitors as well as staff coming into the facility. One of the things that we were recently doing about a couple months ago, we started is, how are we going to take the temperature? And yesterday we had the pleasure of being on one of these panels with a physician. Their receptionist at one of the institutions that she oversees as chief medical officer has been impacted by the COVID-19 virus. She's actually, is dealing with it. She was taking the temperature of staff as they were coming into the facility. One of the first things our team did as this thing started to become real is like, how do we do this going forward when things open up a little bit without putting one of our, staff directly on the front lines of dealing with dozens upon dozens of people that come to the facility. So for instance, remote temperature sensing, and such that we can take the temperature outside, that information is securely communicated to the reception desk, and we can determine whether somebody meets that baseline threshold for either coming into the facility or for us to doing an interrogation. So that's one of the things that we're seeing. PPE supplies, right? That's why PPE supplies are so vital. Ms. Arrington, who I get the pleasure of speaking to every once in a while here as part of our mission, is working with FEMA on the national stockpile. The supply chain for PPE is very competitive now. So the U.S. is slowly but surely aggressively moving to a U.S. made in the USA sort of model. We don't want to be competing for ventilators and the new versions of ventilators that we're discovering we really need to treat the disease, or even mask, with our adversaries or the supply chain that the nation has traditionally relied on. I can't avoid the elephant in the room, China, right? So we have to go to U.S. manufacturing. So as we go to U.S. manufacturing, how do we protect U.S. manufacturing right when we think things are still, there's a second wave or a third wave, or the virus morphs and we're still battling this thing? We have to keep the nation safe.
Yes. One of the things I think I'd also add to that is what I see coming out of this is there's going to be a new normal. I hate that term. It's been overused, but it's true. And a lot of companies are not going to go back to the way it was before. They're going to have more remote access. Remote access is going to be more the norm, I think, for a very, very long time. And I worry about how does that impact having less people actually on site. Is one degree of cyber protection, even though it's more from a eyes on type of thing. And one of my worries is that with less people on site, does that also affect the cyber posture of companies?
Yeah, we have all these endpoints in the wild, right? Some of them were properly structured because some organizations were already, let's face it, the commercial sector has a large population of their workforce that was used to already working remotely. If you look at the Googles and this, the Apples and, right. And the Amazons, they're pretty comfortable, pretty well prepared. In fact, some of these organizations are extending their work from home policies for some of the employees that would periodically come into the office all the way through the end of the year to try to skip over or reduce the impact of a potential reinfection or a second wave, as the community likes to call it. So that's how they're tamping that down, measuring the size of the workforce or reducing it. The size of the workforce. So I'm here in this lab. There's some really smart, brilliant people whose minds and work ethic we just could not get our work done without. So that we have to be very, very careful about engaging with each other such that we don't take out a certain segment of our workforce, right? Because that basically reduces mission resiliency or mission, the ability to execute the mission. We've been pretty good about it. Well, we have a supply of masks here. I have like 15 of them, that I have, and we operate out of different aspects of the facility. We can spread out pretty good here. On any given day, there's X number of people here, right? That's definitely reduction in force. But as things start to intensify on the return to work, we're trying to figure out how do we do that properly, not just to our staff, but the DOD and other mission critical customers who rely on their interactions with us. So teleworking, remote, access to information. We're running a critical infrastructure event here next week. That was supposed to be an in-person sort of event. It's now going to be remote. That's a great example. Our ability to collect remote sensing data with your help and the help of some of the other tools that we have in here, such that we don't have to go knock on a factory door to get a network map or an asset map or a vulnerability scan. We can drop and ship and, like we like to say, plug and begin to comply. That's the strategy that we're using, reducing travel, reducing physical presence.
Right. In the broader scheme of things production levels might never come back to the same way they were before. you know, how is that going to change? I guess that's more of an open question. How is that going to change things as we go forward?
Yeah, so production levels, I mean, with the factories that we're engaging with, even through this COVID-19 challenge, I would actually ask, and I continue to ask, you know, we're meeting with a group of manufacturers later on this afternoon. We ask typically, how is this impacting their ability to continue to, you know, produce the products that they, you know, that they run their businesses by. So some of them have seen, you know, volunteer absenteeism. I'm afraid to go to the factory. We all hear the stories about what's happening in the meat processing plants, right? You know, massive clusters of infections. And so a lot of these CEOs are saying, you know, they have a relaxed policy. If someone's really uncomfortable, you know, a lot of manufacturing requires some side by side. And you see here to I have a cobot. Well, what is a cobot supposed to do? The reason it's called the cobot is because it's a cooperative, you know, robotic device, right? It can replace human functions, but technically it sits next to a human, right? So, you know, these are the ways, you know, a lot of manufacturers are looking to keep production going. So we've seen production continue. Has there been an impact? Yes. Are they trying to reduce that impact? Yes. They haven't figured it out at 100%. But you know, that's the livelihood of the nation. Some of the margins aren't great in the small to medium size industrial base that provides most of what we rely on. Mm-hmm. So they have to keep these factories going on. Lights out manufacturing. You know, the Japanese have been great at this for a long time, as have the Germans. Are we going to go to lights out manufacturing? So, you know, I know Chris is familiar with that as you are, John. So those are things, you know, these cobots are, you know, a great representative example of lights out manufacturing.
Greater reliance on robotic and non-people resources in the manufacturing. I think this is actually going to help. You know, I thought there was a great meme a while ago that was, what was driving your digital transformation? And it had CEO, CFO, or COVID. And I thought, well, that's funny. It's probably more truer than a lot of people would like to appreciate, is the virus, the pandemic that we're dealing with is driving folks to rapidly and radically change how they do things. So I think you'll see greater automation, greater types of things, which even provides more concern on the cyber protection aspect of machines rather than people doing things.
Absolutely. And you're still dealing with people, right? People are typically one of the weakest links in any cybersecurity resilience chain, right? So you still have to deal with the individual that's, you know, programming, you know, a device like this, or programming some of the stuff that's slightly over here to my right, the programmable logical controllers and things like that, that are part of a part of any, you know, production environment. So, you know, securing the people that are programming the robots that may be relied upon, just like we've seen at grocery stores, sad but true, right? We're seeing less and less people actually checking you out. They're directing you to these automated scanning stations. Well, you know, Industry 4.0 dictates that while you were maybe running a particular robotic or manufacturing process that's now, you know, been relegated to automation, the new job is in, you know, doing the automation, right? And so transitioning our industrial base to, you know, some more automation, you know, I equate COVID-19 to something I did post 911, where for a particular state, I did a study of what would happen in the event of a biological attack on the state. It was a location that was really close to a lot of other important locations. And the whole idea would be the predictability of how that virus or that, you know, biological event would transition across state lines. Well, what is COVID-19? Something that's transitioned across the water, across the air. It's the equivalent of a non-intentional, even though there's some other rumors out there, biological attack. It's prevented us from getting to our physical work locations for those people that rely on a physical work location to execute the mission. So I think the transition post-pandemic, or whenever we get to that phase, is how do we rely and continue to do mission if we can't physically get to our work locations? How do we do that securely? So I've seen some incredible innovations from the Air Force and some of the things that they've been doing to be able to do near classified or classified work offsite. I think a lot of that's going to happen. How much declassification does the Department of Defense need to do? You know, there's a tendency to classify dramatically everything. But now we have to look, can we segment that out so that it can be done remotely?
We've seen a steady remoting out of all kinds of normal operations that happen within a building. And, You know, I also sometimes think, to add to what you just said, Armando, very, very good points, is I also think about, you know, taking candy away from a baby. So we do all this today to get through the hard time. What happens when we're back to this new norm that John brought up? And we're back, let's say that it does go away. Let's say we have a vaccine and it's no longer a threat. Are we going to take away that remote access somehow? Are we going to reverse the automation that we did? Are we going to take away the cobot? Probably not. So I think a lot of the advancements that we're doing today are permanent. Some might get scaled back, but I think that we're moving in a direction that it's going to be very hard to come back from. I think once employees get used to being able to do their jobs at home remotely, telling them to come into the office and do it less effectively, or give up your remote access, you can't handle an emergency from home anymore, it's going to be a hard sell.
Yeah, COVID-19 is a real life mission recovery or operations recovery exercise. If you didn't have a plan right. for a pandemic, or a plan for when you can't get to your facility, you didn't really test, you know, talking about testing the various aspects of that, you know, recovery plan in the event of a disaster recovery plan, here's your real live test. This is a great opportunity to look at your policies to determine where your critical people are, where your critical assets are, your critical networks, and to begin right. to come up with a resiliency plan of how you continue to operate in the event of a disaster. This is a real life disaster. We're living through it. We all need to take the lessons from this, and we don't need to go backwards, because just like we kind of, right. you know, we get viruses all the time, and there's a debate about whether we could have predicted this or not. This came upon us, and it came across the waters rapidly. You know, exactly. I was in Israel in January, and it was just starting to happen. By the time I got back, you know, to the U.S., you know, I started seeing people wearing masks, and it was still a curiosity as I was going through the airport on my return trip. You know, I started seeing, yep. you know, a heightened increase in that. So yep. this is real, and we should take our lessons to it. And that's how we're working with the industrial base thing. Use this as an example of how you get mission resiliency during a pandemic.
Exactly. Very good advice. Thanks, Armando. And we're getting towards the top of the hour here. So I do think we have a couple QA, if you don't mind. Do you have a couple more minutes here? All right. Yeah. So do you think manufacturers are going to return to normal levels? And what steps are needed now to prepare for that? John, you want to take that one?
Sure. So I think manufacturing production probably will not, right? We're going to likely have shortages in some areas for some time. I think what we need to be prepared for is, was mentioned, is alternative sources, alternative ways of doing more with less, as well as continually testing for resiliency. I mean, I think the, you know, what CMMC is doing from a cyber perspective, and what you know, the testing is being done for a physical perspective, is what's going to be the key to being as prepared as we can for, you know, go the path forward.
Exactly. And we only have about, I think, a minute left, but I wanted to get this last question into you, Armando, if that's okay. What's the one piece of advice that you could give to supply chain manufacturers for improving cybersecurity right now?
You have to be aware, CISA recently published a in partnership with the National Risk Management Center, a set of supply chain risk assessment best practices. So they rely on, you know, five steps. You know, a lot of things have five steps in it, but, you know, it's identify who are your critical resources, identify what's your critical supply chain, you know, that you rely on, assess where your vulnerabilities are, assess what will take you out or your customer out in the event of a critical cybersecurity attack. Manage, you have to set up the management infrastructure for continuously executing, you know, so you need to update your policies, create new policies if you don't have them, and then manage that process, you know, regarding your, you know, supply chain. We use a term here called CYVAR, cyber value at risk. So when we look at assessment, we look at prioritize what's critical to you, not just technology, not just people, but also supply chain. So you have to know where the biggest hits and biggest impacts are going to come from. You got to know, you got to be aware, you have to train, take that information and develop knowledge from it, and then take that knowledge and turn it into action. Training alone won't save you. And the last thing is verify. That's the continuous monitoring, the continuous assessment. Constantly verify what you think should be happening. Trust, but verify, basically.
Sounds great.
Yes. John, Armando, thank you very much for being here today and providing all that valuable advice. We hope today's discussion provided some valuable information that manufacturers can use to improve their supply chain resiliency. So we do have a Department of Defense CMMC compliance mapping guide that will be available shortly. You can also see on your screen, we have some links to some very valuable resources that hopefully will assist you in mitigating the consequences or the stuff that happens with COVID-19. So you can see we have Dreamport's website up for you, MISI as well, some blog that we have out about the supply chain. And as I mentioned, our DoD CMMC compliance guide will be coming shortly. So thank you, everyone. We appreciate your time today. We hope that you stay safe, healthy, and secure.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chris.